for inviting me here to experience firsthand your institute. I hadn't been here before. And for giving me a chance to talk about one of my favorite topics these days, which is the Big Bang Observer, or BBO. Most of you probably are aware of LISA. LISA is a planned space-based gravitational wave mission. You can think of it in the first order as sort of LIGO in space. However, LIGO with much longer arms, with 5 million kilometer arms, so that will be sensitive to gravity waves of a much lower frequency, around a millihertz or so. God and the space agency is willing, LISA might fly in about 10 years, we hope. But today I'm going to be talking about, again, a successor mission to LISA, the Big Bang Observer, that I think even optimistically you couldn't think of as flying before, say, 20 years. So this is a bit out there. But, you know, the Perimeter Institute, I think, would be the ideal place to talk about something that's a bit out there. So it's one of the few places I don't have to apologize for that. The Big Bang Observer, and there's also a Japanese version that's extremely similar called the SIGO, would have the goal of looking for a stochastic gravitational wave background from inflation, to be able to measure stochastic gravity waves down to omega gravity wave around 10 to the minus 17. That's something that LISA cannot do. That was the main goal. That was the main design idea, the concept behind these successor missions. The point of my talk today is something I realized a couple years ago, was that besides being able to measure gravity waves from inflation, a mission like BBO or DeSigo would be a tremendous ultra-high precision cosmology mission, capable of measuring cosmological parameters like the Hubble constant and omega matter and omega dark energy and the W parameters far more accurately than all other missions. Why is that? The basic idea is that in order to measure a stochastic gravity wave background from inflation, BBO or DeSigo would first have to subtract out a very large foreground, basically the foreground from all compact binaries in the universe, all neutron star, neutron star, neutron star black hole, and black hole binaries, all those colliding within a year of, say, of their final collision, hundreds of thousands of them. So for the point of view of measuring the stochastic background, you find them, you catalog them, you take them out of the data. But the point is that's a tremendous catalog. So for each of those neutron star binaries, I'll mostly say neutron star binaries, but I mean neutron star, black hole, black hole, black hole. For each of them, BBO or DeSigo would be able to measure their distance very accurately, on the order of a percent or so. BBO would have tremendous angular resolution for a gravity wave experiment on the order of arc seconds, so that for most sources, you'd actually be able to point in the sky and say, it came from basically that galaxy. So usually be able to uniquely identify the galaxy and then do a follow-up and find the redshift. So you could have something, and there are about 300,000 of these that would be in the BBO data stream. So you'd have about 300,000 points, pretty accurate points, on the distance redshift relation, which 300,000 pretty good points allows you to find an extremely, extremely accurate fit. So that's the basic idea. So the basic idea, again, is really quite simple, but to make sure you really understand it, I'm going to have to give you some background material. So here's the outline of the talk. So I need to pull together some threads of knowledge so you can fully understand things. That's probably take about a third of the talk and talk a little about LISA, a little about standard sirens, a little about BBO, and then I'll get to the real heart of the matter, which is doing ultra-high precision cosmology with BBO. Then I'll point out that BBO is also a great weak lensing mission. I'll talk about some recent work. I'll talk about a few caveats to what I say. I don't think these are any showstoppers, but things one should keep in mind. And so don't take everything I say as being 100% clear. And I'm going to talk about future work. So let me just first one slide about LISA for people who aren't acquainted with it. So LISA, the proposed mission, is an ESA-NASA mission. It's three drag-free satellites arranged like an equilateral triangle there, following Earth around the sun, lagging by about 20 degrees. It's not to scale, but they're about 5 million kilometers between the arms. This triangle is tilted 60 degrees the ecliptic. If you start out that way, then Newton ensures that they always stay in an equilateral triangle tilted 60 degrees the ecliptic. If the triangle tilts around and makes a 360-degree turn once as it goes around the sun. And there are lasers going back and forth between the satellites each way, which measure relative arm length changes. There are lots and lots of sources for LISA, unlike, say, the ground-based detectors. There's thousands and thousands of sources. So especially there'll be tens of thousands of individual white dwarf binaries in our galaxy that are radiating in the LISA band, which is roughly 10 to the minus 3 hertz. LISA will see surely in spirals of black holes, neutron stars, and white dwarfs into million solar mass black holes and galactic nuclei out to about Z equals 1. And so doing, it will explore the sort of the inner geometry of Kerr. It will see collisions of black holes and galactic nuclei out to Z equals 20 or 30. And so thus trace the early history of information of galaxies and of large black holes. Those are things it's almost sure to see. There are also more speculative things to look for, like gravity waves from cosmic superstrings or stochastic gravity waves created by phase transitions at a GEV or a TEV. So we really hope we'll fly in about 10 years. It'll be a terrific mission. And the Big Bang Observer is even a much more ambitious version of that. To understand that this mission, I think I have to tell you a little bit of the politics behind it. That sort of there's a scientific motivation, but it comes with a political motivation. So there are always in bureaucracies, there are always sort of prevailing winds or prevailing murmurs. And about 5 years ago, the word came down from NASA headquarters, the LISA project, that kind of a problem with LISA was that it didn't have a successor mission. I mean, everybody else has a successor mission. Hubble has JWST, COBE has WMAP and Planck. What do we have? You don't want to be, is it a dead end? So I don't think the logic of that is very compelling. But nevertheless, it was conceived as seen as a problem. So Sterl Finney and Bill Faulkner, Caltech and JPL, sort of went off and dreamed up, I think a pretty creative successor mission. And they thought, well, what would be really great? What would be really exciting? Well, inflation's exciting. It'd be nice to prove inflation. And stochastic gravity waves for inflation are something that LISA and LIGO just are not going to see. So we should build something that will see that. And so they designed a mission with that in mind. And so the mission they came up with is basically like four, see there, LISA has three satellites. BBO has 4 times 3 or 12 satellites arranged in sort of four LISA-like constellations. Okay, so I think of it as four mini super LISAs. Mini because they're much shorter arms. These would be 50,000 kilometers, not 5 million kilometers. That brings the frequency range up to around 0.1 to 1 hertz. That's where it's sensitive. But much more sensitive down in strain sensitivity, about 100 times better than LISA. And why this funny configuration? So these are two equilateral triangles here, and then these two overlapping ones forming a sort of Star of David there. What's the point of that? Well, the point is, even at BBO sensitivity, the stochastic background would lie below the noise. That is to say, the random motions of the satellite due to noise will be larger than their motions due to stochastic gravity waves. However, these two overlapping triangles, one of them is just rotated by the other by 180 degrees, and since gravity is a spin two field, 180 degrees rotation is like nothing at all, right? So these two mini LISAs would measure basically the same gravity wave signal, so they'd be correlated, perfectly correlated, in fact. However, their instrumental noises would be uncorrelated. So by sort of multiplying one by the other, cross-correlating them, you could dig down below the noise. So we have these two, the point of these two LISAs is to cross-correlate their signal, right, and dig down below the noise to see the common grav stochastic background, because they both react to the same gravity waves. Well, what about these two other guys? Well, the point is, as I said in my introduction, a problem with this mission, or now a wonderful thing, is that there's a large foreground from all the neutron star binaries in the universe. And the idea is these other guys are supposed to help you identify and subtract out all the neutron star binaries. Okay? That's why we have so many. Just the two. So to look for the graduated background, you cross-correlate these two. And these two are basically just to help you get it, subtract out the foreground. Oh, I'm sorry. No, not at all. So the frequency band is roughly 0.1 to 1 hertz. And the reason for that is that at that frequency band, all the white dwarfs in the universe have already collided. They collide at lower frequencies. So that foreground is completely gone. So all you're left with is the foreground from all the neutron star, black hole, and black holes, which is a very large number, but not so many you can't count them all. Okay? And subtract them all. That's the reason to go to a higher frequency. That wasn't actually Stirl and Bill Faulkner's idea. That had been an idea by Vecchio and Ungarelli. So they took that idea. So this illustrates a few of the things I've said. This would be this black curve would be the BBO noise curve in terms of equivalent strain. So it would have its maximum sensitivity at between 10 to the minus 1 and 1 hertz, getting down to strains around 10 to the minus 24, about 2 orders of magnitude better than LISA. Notice that even for omega gravity wave equals 10 to the minus 15, that's much higher than the noise caused by a stochastic gravity wave background. That's why you need those two overlapping Star of David constellations to dig down and get that far. But above that is this foreground from all the neutron star binaries in the universe, which is sort of like a noise, except it is resolvable, and it's at a level that's higher than the sort of the sum signal from the universe is bigger than the instrumental noise. Even for this ambitious mission. And it is an ambitious mission, so it's a little embarrassing to put these numbers up there, but we're talking about laser power of like 300 watts, mirrors of 3.5 meters, very big mirrors, acceleration noise 100 times better than LISA. So it would be a very ambitious mission. I don't think it's an impossible mission, but it would be very, very expensive. Now, let me talk a little about the neutron star foreground. So if we're just standing here and I start counting gravity waves from neutron stars as they pass over me, as they merge, so in a year, a good, fairly conservative estimate would be I get hit by the gravity waves from about 100,000 neutron stars, just their merger waves. That is to say, in a three-year observation, the BBO would detect about 300,000 mergers. And this is, no one knows exactly, but this is roughly how they're distributed in redshift. So the typical redshift would be around z equals 2 or so, okay? But reasonably well distributed from 0 to roughly around 5, probably. This is a slightly older estimate. The later, newer estimates would maybe be a factor of few higher, but nobody knows for exactly. Let's take this as the number. So 300,000. These binaries take roughly on the order of a year to sweep through the band. So it takes, for instance, about 1 year to go from 0.2 hertz to the end, which is 1,000 hertz. So they're in band basically a substantial fraction of the length of the mission. From 0.1 hertz, it's 5 years. So you should think of them as all there at the same time, basically. Okay, a first question you might ask is it even plausible that you could subtract out 300,000 binaries from the BBO data stream? And that was the first project I worked on for this as part of the concept study, and I wrote a paper with Jan Harms, and we just wanted to come up with sort of an existence proof that some detection strategy was possible. And I'll just tell you roughly how it goes. So it's not necessarily what strategy you would use, but the idea is, at first there's this large noise. It's much larger than the instrumental noise because it's the noise from all the foreground. But there's still always a strongest source, right? And that's still way above all the noise. And you take it out, okay? Once you've taken it out, you've reduced the noise somewhat. And then you can look at the second strongest source and say, that's observable. And to take it out. And then you can keep going. And we basically gave an analytic proof that this process never stops. You go right all the way to the end. You can take them all out. At least we assume that the population dies off around z equals 5, and you can get everything, every single lousy binary, out to z equals 5. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that very well. Phase sources. Fake sources. No, these would all be, okay, good. So these would be have sufficient signal to noise that you would not, I'm pretty sure, you would not have fake sources. So that is to say, these would have signal to noise, you know, even the weakest ones after you've subtracted everything off, like 30. And the chance of having a fake source of having a signal noise of 30, you know, it was going to be something like e to the minus 20 or 220 squared or something like that. So, thank you for saying that. I should have said that. Yes. So to do this, taking these signals out, the point is these signals are very well understood. These are basically like two-point particles. BBO sees them when their R over M is like 1,000, so they're pretty far apart. And we know that these signals, they're very well described by a post-Newtonian expansion. They're far enough apart that you see them long before they get very close and interesting dynamics happen. So we know their waveforms extremely well and can use match filtering to dig them out. Thank you. Okay. Oh, the other thing we realized, however, is that the people who chose the BBO parameters, Stirland and Bill Faulkner, had really pretty good intuition, because if we just dropped the sensitivity by a factor between 2 and 4, it failed to be true that you could subtract all the neutron star binaries. Then if you tried the same procedure, you'd actually stop somewhere, z equals 2 or z equals 3 or something like that, and not be able to go any farther. So you need a very, very sensitive emission to carry out the scheme. Oh, I mean, so we even tried 10 or 100 times more than that, and it didn't change very much. It changed a little bit. For 100 times larger, it might be a problem. Pardon me? I'm sorry. Yeah, so think about it for a second. There are... okay, I'll do the counting quickly for you, but here's how you can think about it. That is not overdetermined. Okay? So there are, four constellations can be effectively 8 different data streams, all reading at, say, you know, a few hertz, okay? Say 3 hertz. So that's, in 3 years, 3 hertz is 3 × 10⁸, okay, times 8 data streams, is 2 × 10⁹, so like 2 × 10⁹ data points. However, I'm subtracting out 300,000 binaries, and each binary is like 10 parameters. So I have, you know, at least a factor of 100 times more data than I have parameters I'm fitting. So it works. Okay. Okay, that was one subtopic. Now I'm going to talk about standard sirens. That's what these gravity wave sources are thought of. They're sort of standard distance measurements. So gravity wave sirens are the gravity wave versions of sort of standard candles. And let me, the point of this slide is really explaining why gravity wave standard sirens are in some sense much better than most standard candles you've heard of. And the reason is that they're based on really very simple and fundamental physics. So, for instance, if I have some binary out there, okay, just in the first order, lowest order approximation, you can just to illustrate the point, you can, so with gravity waves, you can estimate using the quadrupole formula. So there's some, quadrupole moment of the two binary, of the two stars. And then the waveform strain at the detector is just goes like 1 over the distance times some projection operator acting on the second time derivative of the quadrupole moment. Okay? That becomes this, that h of t, the measured h of t, goes like 1 over the distance times the reduced mass times r squared times omega squared, which goes like the one over the distance times m1, m2, divided by the total mass, the 1/3, times f to the 2/3. And then to get the response by the detector, you also have antenna pattern functions that show, roughly speaking, how well the polarization of the antenna is lined with the polarization of the gravity waves, right? But those are things that you can use that with LISA or with BVO, you can figure out what those angles are pretty accurately. You can figure out what the masses are from the evolution, from the rate at which the frequency evolves. So to lowest order, the FDT goes like the same combination, M1, M2 over M to the 1/3, F to the 11/3. And you get similar, the same moral is happens if you carry things out to higher post-Newtonian order. The evolution tells you the parameters like the mass and the spins. You can usually figure out the angles because these constellations are moving throughout the year, so you have a time-changing antenna pattern, so it allows you to determine all the angles. And so you've made accurate measurements of this, and you get them, they get the distance out, because the distance goes is basically 1 over the amplitude. Okay? And the point is, it's all very fundamental, simple, almost freshman physics, or at least first-year graduate school physics that goes into it, and it's not like, say, a supernovae, okay, where we don't, it's hard to even make supernovae explode on the computer, and you don't, we have phenomenological laws that say, you know, if it lasts such a length of time, then it's probably so bright, but there's scatter in that. We don't know how it evolves with redshift. It's just a much more simple and direct physics. So that's why these gravity wave sirens are so nice. And the previous transparency, I was sort of implicitly assuming flat space, but in the cosmological context, what you actually measure, not the distance, but of course there are different notions of distance, and what you get directly is the luminosity distance, and what you measure directly are the redshifted masses, masses times 1 plus z, because everything is basically redshifted. And for a little more historical context, as far as I know, it was Bernard Schultz who first pointed out this fact that gravitational wave, that binaries are these great standard sirens, that is, for getting the distance. But he also pointed out that the problem is, so in most of astronomy, redshifts, electromagnetic astronomy, redshifts are easy and distances are kind of hard. And in gravity wave astronomy, it's just exactly the opposite. You, from the gravity waveform itself, you know nothing whatsoever about the redshift. So the thought for most times has been you need some sort of electromagnetic counterpart, like a gamma ray burst or some jet or something else that sort of lights up. And so you can then point at it and get the redshift. And then you're really off to the races in doing astronomy, in doing cosmology. And then Holtz and Hughes picked this up in 2005, and they asked just what could LISA do with just a handful of binaries? It's expected of sort of, you know, million solar mass black holes colliding. It's expected there'll be many more than that that the LISA will find, but let's say you just get lucky a few times and something electromagnetic goes off. And they realized two things. One was if you just look at the distance errors due to the detector noise, you could do really quite well with the handful. For instance, you could measure the Hubble constants at, say, 1%. But they also realized sort of a fly in the ointment that Bernard hadn't realized, which is that there's a problem with lensing, with weak lensing. So just as it's true that when a galaxy, the photons from a galaxy come towards you, they get sheared and magnified or demagnified by the clumpy intervening matter. And it's also the same is true of the gravity waves coming towards you. They get, the shear isn't so important, but the magnification is. So typical magnifications are a few percent, and they have follow some distribution, and they're random, but with some distribution. So that, so for any given one of them, that's what causes an uncertainty in the distance. So what you basically, so you're not measuring the real luminosity distance, but sort of the real luminosity distance divided by the square root of the magnification. All right? So that's a problem. Okay. But that's if only if you have a few. So now I finally come to the BBO story. What I realized just, you know, not quite 2 years ago, well, I somehow never asked myself, what's BBO's angular resolution? But as soon as I did, I thought about it, I said, oh my God, it's really great. So we're used to, unfortunately, in the gravity wave business, angular resolution being kind of lousy by natural astronomy. So, Lise's angular resolution is best usually a degree. LIGO's is at best usually a degree. So that's usually the standard answer. But actually, for BBO, if you just do a simple estimate of the back of the envelope, you see it has to be something more like an arcsecond. Well, why is it so good? Well, basically, a rough estimate is that delta theta goes like, you know, the number of 1 over the number of gravity wave cycles in the distance between the detectors. In geometrical units, the difference between the detectors is like an AU or like 500 seconds. And then if you put in, you know, the typical frequency, and then, of course, the angular resolution improves with the signal to noise, and these will have typically have signal noise of 1 or 200. And if you just put in those numbers, you get something like an arcsecond. That's just a rough estimate. There's also sort of a standard recipe for estimating, for calculating how well a detector can measure certain quantities. If you know the noise characteristics of the detector and you know what you're looking for, sort of a fissure matrix approach. It's not completely accurate, but it's accurate up to corrections of order 1 over the signal to noise. So I did those calculations, and here's what comes out. These are the median angular resolution in arcseconds squared for neutron star, black hole, neutron star, and black hole binaries. And you say even at z equals 2, median angular resolution for neutron star binaries would be what, you know, 60 or so arcseconds, something like that. So it's pretty, that's much, much tighter. Squared, 60 arcseconds squared, sorry. Exactly, that's what I mean. So the so then to get the arcseconds, you divide by pi and take the square root, so like 4 arcseconds, right. Thank you. Several arcseconds. Okay, what about the distance resolution? Well, the back of the envelope argument is always that the distance resolution, delta D over D, is always roughly of order 1 over the signal to noise, which again would be typically about 1%. And again, a more careful Fisher matrix estimate basically validates that. It's, you know, the order of a percent or so. Oh, a little bit worse for neutron star. Neutron star binaries, a little bit better for black hole binaries because they have stronger SNR. So these are the results of Fisher matrix calculations. But again, we get hit by what Holtz and Hughes realized, you know, a few years ago, was actually that the dominant distance uncertainty is not errors due to noise, but errors due to weak lensing. They dominate. So it actually, the RMS error in the distance is about 4.4% times the redshift. That's a rough average, right? So at z equals 1, typically you're going to make a 4.5% error, RMS. And that dominates over the 1% you're going to make from the instrumental noise. Okay, so we have a few percent error in the distance, a few arcseconds uncertainty in the angular and sky location. How many galaxies are in such a cylinder? Imagine I take a cylinder of, you know, a few arcseconds in radius and a few percent of the distance across, and how many are in that cylinder? Well, based on the Hubble Ultra Deep Field surveys, which has maybe 1,000 galaxies per arc minute squared, this is the average number of galaxies in one of those cylinders for neutron star, black hole, and black hole. For neutron stars, it reaches a maximum of about 33%, maybe 35% or so at z equals 2. But in most places, it's, you know, less than around 20%, and it's always less than around, on median, around 35%. This is for most error boxes, most error cylinders, there's only one galaxy in there, right? So most of the time, you can uniquely identify the galaxy. Not all the time, you'll make some errors, but most of the time. Okay? In our paper, I argued that, okay, so you'll get most of them right, and you get some of them wrong. And the wrong ones will just be outliers. So you should have some, without actually demonstrating, I said there should be some robust statistic you can say, should have, that you know, some of them really fit the universe, and some of them are way off. Those are the misidentified guys. And the fact that you have some big outliers probably shouldn't affect how well you measure the universe's parameters. So based on that assumption or that idea, Dan Holtz and I did a simple calculation. I'll just tell you what goes in and what comes out. So we assumed that we have, say, 250,000 neutron star, neutron star binaries that we've correctly identified and found their redshifts for. We've assumed that we found their redshifts perfectly. And we assumed that there are, say, five parameters that describe the universe, the Hubble constant, omega matter, omega dark energy, and two in W standard, W0 and WA, you've heard so much about in the last few days. And following the sort of standard convention in cosmology, when you're trying to predict how well a future mission can do, we also assumed a forecasted Planck priors on omega matter, that omega matter times h squared will be known to about 1%. And we also assumed a constraint on the angular diameter distance of the Hubble scale at decoupling. Those are the two things you get from CMB. So we put those in as well as priors. And then what comes out? Well, it turns out that then if you had 250,000 neutron stars out to z equals 3, you could, with that five parameter family, you could constrain the Hubble constant to about 0.1%. So current, that's about 50 times better than the current constraint, which is about 5%. If you took a simpler model, you could, just a lambda CDM model, so W0 is equal to minus 1, WA equals 0, fewer parameters, you could actually measure the Hubble constant to a 40th of a percent. Okay. Well, how well could you measure W0 and WA, these parameters defining the dark energy, how it changes with time? Well, we chose to look at this, as Dick Bond told you yesterday, there's a standard figure of merit that's used in the dark energy world. I don't endorse it any more than he does, but this is for compared with other people. There's a figure of merit. This is the black oval here is the one sigma error you would find on this plane, and the dotted line is the two sigma error. And the figure of merit is the inverse area of that ellipse. And for BBO, it would be about 10 times better than all other dark energy emissions combined. And you'd measure W0 to about 7/10 of a percent, and WA to about 5%. So again, the basic point is with 300,000 standard candles or standard sirens, you do extremely well. In the interest of truth in advertising, I will point out one sort of caveat to this, because I don't want to hide anything from you. So I'll tell you one thing that is a little bit just slightly worrisome. I don't think it's a real problem, but I'll tell you about it anyway. I don't think it's a killer problem. I've assumed so far that BBO will have the kind of calibration accuracy that everybody expects for LISA. So everyone who works on LISA expects that LISA will be calibrated to at least about a part in a million. That is to say, if you measured trillion distances with LISA, so each one would have some statistical variation, but the systematic error would only be one part in a million or so. And the basic argument is that in LISA, all you're measuring is you're measuring different distance changes in units of the wavelength of the laser light. And you know the wavelength of the laser light extremely well, basically to a part in a million. You could probably do it better if you wanted. And to get strain, you divide that by the length of the arms, but you know those much better than a part in a million. So it's all self-calibrating, is the way Karsten Donsman likes to say it. Now, if you know anything about gravity wave astronomy, you'll know that for the ground-based detectors, the calibration isn't nearly that good. So for LIGO today, the calibration is about 8%. That is to say, if LIGO tells you the distance, besides, it hasn't seen anything, but if they did see something, they would tell you a distance with a statistical error, say 10%, and a systematic error of, say, 8%. Why is it so different for LIGO than for LISA? And the difference is that in LIGO, they're always trying to push on the masses to keep the interferometer on a dark fringe, basically. So if the gravity waves are sort of moving the masses apart, you push back almost as hard on them to try to keep everything centered on the dark fringe. So what you end up having to do in determining the strength of the gravity waves is also figure out how hard you pushed on the test mass. And it turns out just to be very, and these are very tiny pushes, and it turns out to be very hard to do that to better than a few percent. LISA is different. There's no pushing on the test mass. They really are in free fall. There's no pushing on the test masses in the sensitive direction. So we think that it's completely different. When Stirl, Finney, and Bill Faulkner came up with their sort of concept study and their concept study design, they basically took the LISA mission idea and they just scaled things. Okay? You know, scaled up the size of the mirrors and scaled up scaled down the arm lengths and everything like that. But something that Harry et al. Noticed a few years later is they'd made sort of one mistake, at least. If you just scale everything up like that and ask how much power ends up coming on the photodiode of the detector in BBO when you're trying to measure a phase, it ends up being super saturating all current photodiodes by about a factor of 1,000. Basically because the mirrors are bigger and closer and the lasers are stronger, and you end up having too much power in the photodiodes by a lot. So they propose an alternative design, which is more LIGO-like, where you always were pushing on the mirrors a little bit. So you're always at a dark fringe, and you don't supersaturate the photodiodes. On the other hand, because they weren't thinking at all about this calibration problem, they never thought about it, in fact. I talked to them, and they said, oh, we never thought about that. So I really don't like their design idea, but we still need some sort of fix. So I've talked to several experimentalists about this, and most of them are all optimistic that this is a solvable problem. I had one idea that you just take the final beam and use optics to spread the beam out a little bit so it covers 1,000 photodiodes. No one saw anything wrong with that. Or you could maybe use a LIGO-like mission, everyone thinks they could do a much better job of actually calibrating the force, so they tried harder. So there are many possible solutions to that, but no one's actually sort of written it up and sent it into referee journal or anything like that. So I would raise that as a caveat, this calibration question. Okay, so modulo this calibration question, which I think is probably, I think it's small compared to other questions. I try to demonstrate that because of all these standard sirens, you'll measure cosmological parameters extremely well. I'm now going to switch topics and say it's also, BBO would also be a fantastic weak lensing mission. So far I've talked about sort of the largest scale structure, of a homogeneous universe. All the parameters I've talked about would describe a universe with no structure at all. But BBO would also be very good at figuring out what the small scale structure is that causes weak lensing. Why is that? Well, so imagine you took all the BBO's 250,000 data points to 300,000 data points and plotted them on a graph like this, where here's z and here's the log of the distance, basically. So you'll get so the red curve is the real universe, and you get some little scatter around it, right? And then this inset is just a blow up of a piece of that around there. So let's blow that up. And now consider just one point, that's one binary that this went off, okay? Why isn't it on the red curve? Well, there are two reasons it's not on the red curve. One, there was some noise in the detector, but we said that was small. So that's a small fraction of it. The main reason it's not on the red curve is because it got lensed. And in this case, it got magnified, so we thought it was at a closer distance. Okay? So you actually, for every single one of those binaries, you measure the amount of lens that is lensed to something like 10 or 20%. 20%, say, because the lensing is about 5 times bigger than the noise. So you get 300,000 independent measurements of gravitational lensing, weak lensing, each with signal noise of 5 or so. how good is that compared to any other kind of weak lensing mission? Well, we've only sort of scratched the surface of this, but we can make a couple estimates. One, you can sort of make a sort of a rough singlet noise squared of weak lensing for the entire sort of catalog you have, just as a sort of a figure of merit. So that would be just the single noise squared for the whole lensing catalog would be the sum over how much the lensing divided by the error in the lensing squared. It's around 10 to the 7. And that's very comparable to the most ambitious sort of JDAM or LSST missions. Or you could say, how well could BBO measure, say, the convergent power spectrum? This is something that people like to measure in weak lensing. And if the black curve is the real universe, the error bars you would get from BBO would be the one sigma error bars you see in red. And that's better than you see anywhere else, I claim. So it would be an excellent weak lensing mission. Not as good as an ultra-precise cosmology mission, but an excellent weak lensing mission. As I said, that we've only sort of scratched the surface of that weak lensing part. So the next thing to do, what we want to do, is see how well you could use these weak lensing measurements to constrain cosmological models, like, you know, different parameters describing structure, K, and see if there are any synergies you could get by combining gravity wave magnifications with all the information you get from the shear measurements from LSST. Maybe there are gains from that, I don't know. So that was a brief description of BBO as a weak lensing mission. We haven't done as much work on that. If you start thinking about it, you can start thinking of lots of different science investigations you can do. I don't have time to talk about them all. Let me just mention one for now. You can ask me more in the questions if you want. But for one thing, BBO would be an early warning system for every gamma ray burst in the universe, right? Short gamma ray bursts. So this is assuming, as most people think, that short gamma ray bursts come from the collisions of neutron stars or neutron stars and black holes. That's the usual paradigm these days. And if that's, but BBO sees all of them, right? And not only that, but months before they happen, you'll be able to say, you'll be able to tick them all off, right? You say, you'll be able to give everybody a little calendar with, you know, dotted lines on each day. And you say, you know, today is Wednesday. It's 10 minutes to 3. We're expecting another one in 3 minutes and 22 seconds. And it'll be over there to within a few arc seconds. So point at that, right? Or, more likely, you'll say, you know, today, what we expect is there'll be one there, 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 a few hundred. But most of them won't be quite face on. But that one will be really face on. And we know these things are beams, so that was a really good candidate. These others are a little bit off, so maybe you look for afterglows from those. And those, maybe you'll get lucky or something. Right? Because we'll know the orientations as well. So you just be there waiting for them. You can see if anything interesting happens beforehand. You can look for afterglows afterwards. So it's an all-sky short gamma ray burst monitor. Okay. Now I'm going to just come in the last 10 or 15 minutes. How much more time do I have? Okay. I'm going to talk about some more recent work. This is what I'm going to describe right now. Doesn't change the big picture at all, but I thought it was a little interesting. I'm going to talk about it. I gave a talk like this several months ago, actually almost a year ago, at Caltech. And Chris Harada came up afterwards, and he was very interested. And he read their paper, and he made a couple of very interesting suggestions. I'm going to tell you a couple of them. So one was, he pointed out that we're overly simplistic at one point. So I'd said early on, many slides ago, that the typical RMS error in the distance you make due to weak lensing is about 4.5% times Z for a single source. And then when Dan Holtz and I wrote our paper, we sort of implicitly assumed that that meant that if you have N sources in a sort of narrow redshift bin, then the error for that ensemble of N sources would be that 4.5% times Z divided by the square root of n. And Chris, who's a very clever guy, pointed out that that's only if you use the average as an estimator, and that because the distribution of magnifications is quite skew with a long tail, that's not the best way to do the estimate. that if you do a maximum likelihood estimate, you do rather better, about 50% better. And even if you have only, say, four sources, it's more like 0.3% divided by n to the 1/2. So we wrote a paper on that, and almost at the same time, another paper came out with the same idea by Shang and Heyman. And so, for instance, that just makes things a little bit better. So if you look at number of sources, BBO is over here, around 300,000. And if you look, think into this dark energy figure of merit, so by making this correction, it goes up from almost 10,000 to more like 20,000. So it just got a little better. It's fine, I always like that. Chris also pointed out something I had missed in our first paper. I'm a little embarrassed I missed it. I'll tell you about it. He pointed out that there was this sort of subtle, I'll call it subtle because I missed it, a subtle selection effect. This is the following. I thought of selection effects when I wrote our first paper, but I thought, oh, I don't have to worry about that. BBO measures every single binary in the universe. There's no selection effect. We get them all. But what Chris pointed out was there actually is a little bit because you don't get the right galaxy for all of them. You have a probability of getting the right galaxy, and unfortunately, it's not completely random. Because if things are magnified a little, you have a slightly better chance that you'll get the right galaxy. Why is that? Well, if it's magnified a little bit, that means the signal is a little stronger, so you get a slightly smaller error bar. Moreover, the galaxy is a little brighter, so it's a little easier to find. So you make a little bit more errors when it's demagnified and a little bit fewer errors when it is magnified. So that's a systematic effect. And if you hadn't thought about it, you can ask how big a systematic effect is it? I estimate it's something like a 0.1% distance error. So that seems small by usual astronomy standards, but unfortunately it's large compared to all these statistical errors. I said we're so small. Now, neither Chris nor I thinks that this is a killer problem. I think it's something that you can solve. It just means you have to be a little bit more sophisticated in how you do your analysis. And this is something I've been thinking about lately. There are a couple of calculations I would like to do. I hope it's true that a more sophisticated analysis, you can basically take out this effect. Let me just sketch a couple ideas for trying. One, these are two ideas I thought of. I'll probably try the first one. You can imagine trying to calibrate it out. Okay, how would you calibrate out this effect? Well, fortunately, I told you that BBO will measure every single gamma ray burst, right? Like, what's special about the gamma ray burst is probably just the fact that we're seeing them face on. But when you have a gamma ray burst, you'll know exactly which galaxy it is, right? Okay. So because you can go back and you see the afterglows, you get optical identifications. So those, you should be able to identify the galaxy perfectly. Okay, based on those, say, 1,000 perfectly identified galaxies where there are homes of neutron star mergers, you can now create a new synthetic data set. You populate those galaxies with binaries with arbitrary orientation, hundreds of thousands of them, and with arbitrary coalescence times, and then you make a new data set based with those binaries. And now you analyze it two different ways. You analyze it the standard way, where you don't use the information from the gamma ray bursts, and you analyze it knowing where they came from, and see what distant difference you make in estimating the differences, what the systematic effect is. And you can do that as many times as you want. So you should be able to measure the systematic effect, most of it, and take it away. And the question is exactly how much you can take it away. Can you take it away 99% or 90%? And that's something to calculate. Or you can imagine doing a proper Bayesian analysis. And to do a proper Bayesian analysis, you have to be able to measure the probability of any sort of particular set of observation giving parameters that describe the universe. And to do that, really, unfortunately, you have to complicate the model. To really predict what you would have seen, you have to start putting in parameters like the rates of neutron star mergers in elliptical galaxies and the rates of neutron star mergers in spiral galaxies and how they evolve with Z. So maybe you need 20 or 30 more parameters, and you would try to have to fit the whole thing, also using all the everything else. And I think that would probably work because, again, we have 300,000 data points. So we still have much, much more data than parameters to fit. But what can always go wrong is there could be, you know, I don't think there would be, but you could be worried that there are sort of subtle correlations between these nuisance parameters and the things that you're interested in, which substantially degrade your accuracy. So these are both calculations I would like to do. Fortunately, nobody's running out to build this thing right now, so I have a little bit of time. Okay, so far in this talk, I've just talked about sort of scientific and technical issues. When I describe this, when I've given this spiel a few times before, there are always two kinds of reactions. Some people get, you know, quite excited and say, yeah, let's go out and do it. And some people look at me like, you know, I'm obviously very unrealistic. And they say, and you can just see what they're thinking in their eyes. I mean, they're usually polite. But they look at you, say BBO, and you can just see that they're thinking this. You get it? It's pie in the sky. So let me, that's probably more than half the people. So let me just talk about pie in the sky for a bit. So first, I will make the comment that it's mostly Americans who think it's pie in the sky for some reason. In Japan, they're really excited about this. So they have this sort of road there. There's this big DeSigo team, and they proposed to build a DeSigo Pathfinder, and they came in the last final two for a launch opportunity last year, and they lost. They were number two, but they're putting another proposal this year, and they have a very ambitious, extremely ambitious proposal anyway for how to get from DeSigo to pre-DeSigo to real DeSigo. So without doing any lease in between, so they like this idea a lot. And they have actually a sort of an interesting design that is probably much more economical. They have, their idea was actually to make it more LIGO-like, to shrink it from BBO's 50,000 kilometers to 1,000 kilometers, and to make Fabry Perot cavities of the arms that allows you to shrink the mirror size, allows you to lower the laser power, a lot of things to go way down. Experimentalists like this a lot. They all say, this is the way to go. However, I will point out that, again, there's more. If you make it LIGO-like, you're going to have this calibration problem, because LIGO has a calibration problem. So I don't know. Maybe you could fix that here. But this is a cheaper alternative. Pardon me? Oh, a Fabry-Perot cavity is that the light comes in, and there are two mirrors, and it bounces back and forth many, many times. No, I'm sorry. This is gravity wave jargon. This is laser jargon. Between two mirrors is a cavity. The other point I want to make is, again, both the BBO design and the DeSigo design are still based on the original goal of measuring stochastic background from inflation, which might not even be there anyway. What I've said is it's a tremendous mission for doing cosmology and weak lensing and gamma ray bursts and lots of other things. So maybe if you just sort of threw away the original motivation and built a mission around that, you could, all the parameters are up for grabs now. You can imagine changing the number of satellites. You can imagine moving in frequency space. So you can imagine looking at, varying lots of parameters and seeing how the science yield changes as you try to make a mission cheaper. So that's work in progress. Whereby work in progress means I barely started, but it's work in progress. So one idea, for example, so if you're not going to measure stochastic gravity waves, you don't need that Star of David anymore. Just throw it away. Instead, by the time BBO flies, there should be third generation telescopes on the ground that are supposed to be sensitive down to about 1 hertz. So the Einstein telescope is the one is what they call it in Europe. That's now overlapping now with the BBO sensitivity band. It's not as sensitive as BBO, but it overlaps. And so if you had two BBO-like constellations instead of four and the Einstein telescope on the Earth, I think you could probably do almost as well at half for half the cost, I suspect. I have to check that. So I come to my summary, which is that if we could build find an affordable version of VBO and modulate these caveats that I've tried honestly to mention about calibration, then you get this gold mine, this catalog of hundreds of thousands of compact binaries, which are all standard candles, which allow you to measure cosmological parameters to amazing precision with using basically just fundamental physics that we understand. It's a great weak lensing mission. It's an all-sky monitor for gamma ray bursts. I haven't mentioned, but you would observe all the earliest black collisions of black holes back to Z equals 20, or the very first black holes ever, and you'll see them with signal noise of a thousand and measure their parameters. Is Lee Smolin in the room? He must be excited by that. There's strong lensing applications. There are many others. It'd be a fantastic mission, so it would be nice to try to find a way to make it affordable. Okay, thank you. Yes. Yes. It is, but the signal has a signal much longer. So LIGO sees it for a few minutes. We see it for a year. It goes like the sensitivity goes like the square root of the number of cycles. If you put it all together, the answer is yes. Yes, Pierre? What do you mean? Well, it's a vector. So, two things. Okay, two things. Okay. So, you're right. So for W naught and WA, maybe a factor of three better than either of them. Okay, that's what I was. Than the most ambitious versions. But I guess the reason I said amazing, if I'm to defend it, is because if you talk to the people who are even working on JDEM, they all think that these are sort of too optimistic numbers, and the reason is because they don't have any systematics in them. So people are worried about, but So I told you the only two things I think I'm being optimistic about. So there's the calibration issue, which is a design issue. It's certainly solved in LISA. And then there's this question of the selection effects, which I agree. So I haven't proved it yet. I suspect we can solve it. But then after that, I'm not sure. I don't think I'm being optimistic. So then you can say, well, there's a factor. So it's a factor of three each, much, much better. So maybe I should have tamed that down a bit. Okay, so I guess I was thinking much more of the systematics. You're right, if you look at this quoted statistical errors, it's only, in terms of this dark energy figure mirror, it's only a factor of 10 better. Okay, so maybe incredible was too incredible a word. Yeah, well, JDEM, which JDEM does weak lensing and. Yeah.
Well,
but that's not okay. Thank you. I probably should have put it that way. So you're right. I probably should have said it differently. Misha? Yes? No, I don't know yet. I mean, I know. Obviously, you're in that camp. Obviously, they're going to fly JDAM before they're going to fly this. Obviously, there's no way I'm going to get it down below a few billion dollars, right? So, but you don't know in JDAM just to be that what the systematics are going to be like. You really don't, right? It could be that those, BAO maybe it's smaller, but for supernovae and weak lensing, it's hard to know how small you can make the systematic errors. So, but we don't know how cheap I can think of how to make this mission. So I guess I give this talk before I next time I have to be much more complimentary to all the other missions. Okay, obviously I did a really bad selling job and I've learned my lesson. Okay, yeah, yes. Oh, okay. Oh no, I agree with you. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks. Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. So. Or that W0 and W, I agree with you. You know, are a decent model. Yeah. I agree. So. That's another point, actually, right? So the comparison of the figure of merit, so that's like just to be fair, the figure of merit is, you know, the usual one is only diagnostic if it's a really simple universe, and we don't know that.
I guess maybe one other term.
No, let them go. I just rebutted. They get another rebuttal. Oh my God, variation of fundamental constants between now and z equals 5. What, you have to, you mean, what, see, you mean, which one? Well, G, presumably, I said the universe is 10 billion years old. The universe is 10 billion years old. You mean from z? I don't know. Yeah, but they still have mass. They don't need to be 1.4. I never use. Oh yeah, you'll find out. Yeah. Okay. I guess all I need, the only thing I need from this is for general relativity to be the same. Anything else can change. Can I test what? I would strongly guess you could, but I haven't tried to think of that. But I haven't tried. I think what's much better for that, presumably, is something like LISA, where you see them. You know, LISA will measure some things with signaloids of 1,000, a few maybe, and they're much closer together, so in a much more relativistic regime. I thought of it as a sort of a selling point of BBO. You're getting them. You're measuring when they're pretty far apart. And where it's, you know, almost quasi-Newtonian. So I don't think of it as a relativity testing mission. I think of it as a complement to JDAM.
I was just going to add a comment in terms of the relative timing of the missions. That I guess if CMB missions show that R is less than a few percent, then omega gravity wave is going to be less than 10 to the minus 16. It's going to be out of the range of BBO anyway. So you would go ahead and, I mean, the way it goes is that if it's, well, yeah. So the way it goes is if it's like as high as it can, if R is 0.3 now, because of the way the slope relates with the amplitude, as long as R is between a few tenths and 1%, then omega gravity wave is between 10 to the minus 16 and a few times 10 to the minus 16. But then if you go below that, as you begin, then the thing is flattened out enough that as you lower things on CMB scales, you just lower them linearly on interferometer scales. So I'm just saying, on the bright side, probably, you know, it could be that in a few years you can scale back the mission guilt-free.
Okay.
So if there's no further questions, the next talks will begin in, will be up in Bob again, up in the fourth floor. Thanks.
Thank you.